Welcome to the Harbor Fellowship Church Podcast.
One of the most iconic, one of the most memorable, famous lines in English literature comes from Oliver Twist, Dickens' famous novel. Oliver's working in a workhouse. He's very hungry. He's been fed a bunch of gruel. All the orphans eat their gruel. Oliver is still hungry, so he grabs his bowl. He walks up to the cook, and he says, "Please, sir, I want some more." Yes. They changed it in the musical to, "Please, sir, may I have some more?" Why would you mess up the only line we all know? I don't know. But this is what happens. And Oliver is hungry. He goes and asks for more. The cook smacks him with a ladle and then tries to have him hung. It's a really fun story for kids. Three characters in this moment, three characters in this story that I want to point out to you. First character is all the other orphans behind Oliver. I realize that that's more than one character, but shh, I don't care. All the other orphans behind Oliver, that's our first character here. They are all hungry. All of them are hungry. None of them have been fed enough, but they are still seated on the bench. That's our first character. Second character we have is Oliver himself. He is hungry, and he has had the audacity to pick up his bowl, walk up to the front, and ask for more. And then our third character, of course, is the cook. The cook who Dickens tells us is incredibly fat. That's Dickens' description of him, which means he has food. He's got lots of it. He's just not willing to give any to the orphans. When Jesus teaches his Beatitudes, when Jesus tells us the Beatitudes, he is going to give us two of these three characters. He is going to describe people who are spiritually malnourished, who are hungry spiritually, or at least they're desperate for food spiritually. And he's going to tell us about people who stay seated on the bench, who are desperately malnourished, but who sit there and remain hungry, convince themselves that they're not, or convince themselves they can find food on their own later. Then he's going to tell us about people who are desperately malnourished spiritually, who stand up, who lift up their bowl and say, "Please, sir, may I have some more?" But then there's this distinct difference between Oliver Twist and what Jesus is telling us, because the cook is not in the Bible. What Jesus describes for us is a God who, unlike the cook, is incredibly generous, and who is going to give and give and give some more. Jesus is going to say, in the verses we will read, he will say, "Blessed are those who recognize their desperate need, who acknowledge it, who stand up with their bowl and ask the God who will definitely say yes to give them more." Matthew 5, if you've got a Bible, that's where we're going to be this morning. Matthew 5. Sometimes we are in desperate need for righteousness, for freedom from sin, for all these things that God so generously provides. We are in desperate need. And for various reasons, we ignore that desperate need. We stay seated on the bench like the orphans in the story. Here's the main point that I'm going to be driving at today, is this idea: if you come hungry, you will be filled. If you come hungry, you will be filled. Matthew 5. And let me read to you the first 12 verses. "Now when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them. He said, 'Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." These verses are called the Beatitudes. We're working through them over the course of several weeks. Today, I want to look with you specifically at verse 5 and 6. "Blessed are the meek, and blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." And what we're going to see today, again, is this idea that those who come hungry will be filled. So what does it mean to be blessed? Let's start with that word, blessed. He says, "Blessed are the meek." Well, the blessing that Jesus speaks of is a happiness or a joy. The word beatitude, we call these the Beatitudes. The word beatitude is just the Latin word for happy. The Happies is what they were called. I like the way that A.W. Pink took it. He translated it as bliss that abides. Bliss that abides. Not a fleeting happiness, but a real, a deep-rooted, a life-changing joy. Bliss that abides, that hangs around. There is bliss that abides for those who are meek and for those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Now, if you jump down to verse 10 and 11, we're getting ahead of ourselves. We're going to cover those in a couple of weeks. But you'll see there in those verses that Jesus says, blessed are people who are persecuted, who are reviled, who are hated, who suffer in all kinds of different ways. So why is that helpful for us? Well, it's helpful to see there that the blessing that Jesus talks about, the bliss or the happiness that Jesus describes, doesn't have anything to do with anything physical. He's not describing anything physical. The number one, there's a new poll this month that says now the number one thing Canadians are worried about is finances. It just changed. I guess it used to be global events. Now the number one thing Canadians are worried about is finances. So you can understand how someone would read this and misunderstand. Jesus says, happy are people who are meek. And you can understand a person would hear that and they would think to themselves, if I am meek, Jesus will help pay my rent this month. Jesus will take away the thing that is stressing me. If I am meek, Jesus will help make me happy. You can understand how someone would misunderstand that. But you jump down to verse 10 and 11, and you can see that the happiness Jesus is offering is completely disconnected from physical well-being. Jesus says that he is offering joy or happiness despite a person's circumstances. You can be happy while being persecuted and reviled and in all sorts of different difficult things. So Jesus is not offering happiness through physical circumstances, but despite them. Blessed are the meek. There's bliss that abides for the meek. So what is meekness? What is meekness? It's an unusual word. You can think of meekness kind of like a sister to humility. It is very similar. Meekness is recognizing one's position and then acting accordingly. If you come hungry, you will be filled. And so meekness is acknowledging, I am hungry. It's just owning that fact about myself, acknowledging who I actually am. The image of meekness you might want in your head, it's kind of this idea of a peasant coming before the king. And the peasant enters the throne room and he's got his head bowed down low. He's looking at the ground. He's in this kind of bow thing because he knows the king is above him and he's only a peasant. He recognizes this disparity in power or in class or in function or whatever you want to call that. But he recognizes that there is a difference. He acts like what he is. Pride or arrogance would come in, head held high, stroll in, I see myself on the same level. Groveling would either put me on the floor or you know, not even willing to enter in the first place. Meekness is not groveling, and it is not arrogance. It is neither of these things. It is someone who enters the throne room with their head at the right height, but they do enter. They do enter. There is some level of audacity, but there is also some level of humility. That is what meekness is. You could think of it, if this is helpful, you could think of it as one aspect of humility. Humility is a big word, covers a lot of things. Meekness is one specific application, just recognizing who you are and acting accordingly. The Beatitudes are kind of, they're a snowball rolling down a hill. We start with, blessed are the poor in spirit, and each one is going to add a layer to that. They're going to build on each other as they go along. And so, blessed are the meek carries on from the two that we studied last week. So last week we learned, blessed are the poor in spirit, blessed are those who mourn. What Austin taught us was, blessed are those who grieve the sin inside of them and grieve the sin in the world around them. The person who is doing that has the ingredients necessary to practice meekness. It's going to come as a result of this. Another way to say that, if I could maybe simplify that for you, it'd be like this. Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. That's kind of like, you know, blessed are people who realize that they are orphans. And then blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who know they didn't get enough gruel and realize it's a problem. And now he says, blessed are the meek. Blessed are the ones who are orphans, who are aware it's a problem that they don't have food, and now are going to acknowledge that problem and go seek a solution. That's kind of the way to think of it. We're building on the two from before us. Come hungry, and you will be filled. Let me tell you a story. hopefully will help illustrate or help you understand this concept. There's a man whose name is Naaman. Naaman is an important military commander. He is the commander of the army of the king of Aram. And Naaman is dying of leprosy. He's an important man. He's a rich man. But for all his wealth, despite all his conquests, he can do nothing to stop the leprosy that is slowly taking over his body. He's covered in sores. He's slowly losing his fingers and toes. Soon, leprosy is going to kill him. Now, on his campaigns as a military commander, he had at one point raided the nation of Israel and taken a bunch of slaves. And so he has in his house, he has a slave girl from the nation of Israel. And the slave girl says to his wife one day, she says, you know, there's a prophet named Elisha in the nation of Israel. And I think if Naaman were to go visit Elisha, he might offer a cure. And so Naaman gathers all his stuff, all his entourage, and he heads over to the nation of Israel. And he comes with a letter from the king of Aram that says, please heal my servant Naaman of leprosy. So Naaman goes to the king of Israel with a letter from the king of Aram. And the king of Israel reads this letter and he freaks out. He thinks it's a declaration of war. He's like, you've sent me a guy, another nation has sent me a guy. They say, cure this guy of leprosy. Nobody can do that. These people just want to fight with me. He tears his clothes. He has a whole hissy fit. Elisha hears what's going on and he sends a messenger to the throne room. And the messenger basically says, everybody settle down. Come bring Naaman over to Elisha's house. So Naaman packs up all his stuff. He's got horses and chariots. He's got all these wagons filled with gold and with gifts. And his whole big entourage, they travel over to the house of Elisha. Elisha doesn't even come out to see Naaman. Elisha sends out a messenger. So the messenger comes out to Naaman, and the messenger says to Naaman, hey, if you would like to be cured of leprosy, go down to the Jordan River 7 times and wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan River, and when you come out, you'll be cured of leprosy. And Naaman is like, excuse me, he's super offended by this. He goes, excuse me, that is beneath me. How dare you? I'm an important man, and you're gonna send me to a filthy river to wash? That's gross. There are clean rivers in my own country. There's bathhouses with clean water, and you've sent me down to a filthy river? How dare you? And then Naaman's servants say this line, and I'm gonna put it up on the screen because this is the turning point, and it is so helpful here. Naaman's servants went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you wash and be cleansed? In other words, listen, Naaman, listen, buddy. You were about to give wagon loads of gold. You traveled across the world to try and find a cure for leprosy. You were about to give away everything that you had in order to be cured. Why are you not willing to do something simple? Why are you not willing to do something beneath you? You're willing to do something of your own rank. You're willing to do what military commanders do, which is travel to other nations and make alliances with kings and give away lots of gold. Why are you not willing to do something simple? And so Naaman goes down to the Jordan River. He dips himself in it 7 times. And when he comes out, his skin is cleansed. And then, and this is helpful, this is important, he tries to give all that gold to Elisha, and Elisha says, no thank you. And then we go on, there's a whole nother story after that about the gold and how Elisha definitely does not want it. This story is really helpful for us. It's really helpful for us in understanding meekness because you can think of it almost like two episodes of a TV show. Episode 1, Naaman comes as a high-ranking, important military official. He arrives with pomp and circumstance. He comes with chariots and horses and wagon loads of gold and letters from another king. He comes as someone important and he does not get healed. Why? Because the river he is sent to is gross and he is important. Episode 2 of our TV show starts with this line. The servants say this to him and Naaman is reminded, oh yeah, I'm dying of leprosy and I have nothing to lose. First, he doesn't want Elisha's messenger. He wants Elisha himself. He's like, how dare you send, I'm an important military commander. How dare you send out a messenger? Why don't you send out the prophet himself? He doesn't want the Jordan River. He wants a clean river. He wants everything to be a little bit better, a little bit more important because of how important he sees himself. And then after we read this line, it's almost like Naaman remembers that he's a leper, that he's incurable. He comes wanting to be treated like a military commander, and he has to remember that he's actually just a man dying of a terrible disease. And when he remembers that he is sick and desperate, then he is cured. Healing does not come to Naaman when he arrives with pomp, but when he arrives with meekness. And here's the crazy part about this, and this is why it's helpful for us. Naaman had leprosy the whole time. In both episodes of our little TV show, he had leprosy. He had leprosy when he came with a letter demanding to be cured. He had leprosy when he wished it was Elisha, not just the messenger. He had leprosy when he thought he wanted cleaner rivers and not the Jordan River. He's got leprosy the entire time. He thinks he is an important delegation. He is not. He is a man with a terribly contagious disease who is dying. That's who he is. And here's the thing we know about lepers. Lepers were outcasts in society. Lepers have always been out. Just for the record, leprosy was cured in 1980. It's recent. For all of human history, lepers have been outcasts from society because it's contagious. So you have a big city, and then outside of that city, you would have a little leper colony. This has been how most cities have functioned for all of human history. Lepers lived separately from the rest of us. Naaman does not see himself as a leper. He knows he has leprosy, but he does not see himself as a leper. How do we know that? Well, he shows up in the throne room of more than one king. He goes to the house of Elisha. He's supposed to be an outcast. He knows he has leprosy, but he does not see himself as a leper. And his heart changes when he remembers what he actually is. And then with meekness, he dips himself in the river that he was offered. The Bible tells the story about how sin entered into the world and utterly broke everything. It shattered our relationship with God, with each other, with the world around us. The world is broken. Sin utterly devastated the world, and we deserve punishment for the sins that we so openly love. This is the message that the Bible tells us. But then God, in his great love, sent his son Jesus, who takes the punishment for sin that we deserve. And through his death and resurrection, all of the penalty for sin has been taken away. And because Jesus has died and resurrected and taken away the penalty of sin, we're left with an opportunity. He tells us that if we turn away from our sin and trust in him, trust that he really has come and died and risen again and taken away sin, if we turn and trust, God will make us into brand new people. He will change who we are on the inside. The only thing that we contribute to salvation is the sin that made it necessary. We are just people who are clinging to and trusting in the goodness of a Savior who has died and risen again. A drowning man who grabs onto a life preserver is not contributing a whole lot to his rescue. If he were capable of doing anything to rescue himself, you wouldn't throw a life preserver in the first place. All he's doing is grabbing on and trusting in the people on the other end. That's all that we do as people who are recipients of God's goodness. But we are all prone to the same problem. Some of you have been trusting in the death and resurrection for the forgiveness of your sin. You've been trusting in that for a long time. Some of you have not yet made that decision to trust in the death and resurrection for the forgiveness of your sin. But all of us are prone to the same problem. Naaman knew he had leprosy, but he didn't see himself as a leper. And we do the same thing. You know that you have sin in your life, but you don't see yourself as a sinner. You know that you aren't perfect. You know that you fall short of God's glory, but you still expect some kind of special recognition from God, some kind of special invitation. You don't see yourself as a sinner. Sinners are people who are cast out. Sinners are people who deserve the wrath and the judgment of God. Sinners are people who deserve absolutely nothing from God. They earn nothing from him. And we know that we have sin, but we do not see ourselves as sinners. Meekness says, I know who I am. I know who I am. I'm the lowest of the low.
I've sinned against a holy God. I am in desperate need of a savior. The only thing I contribute to salvation is the sin that made it necessary. I know. I know who I am. And you come with your head low and you say, God, I need your help. God, I need your help. And you just grab on to the life preserver that he's offering through his son, Jesus. And you just hang on to that. And you know that it's just him who has to pull in the rope. You're not contributing anything to this process. You're just coming as you are. And you're saying, I know who I am. I know I deserve nothing from you. I know I don't deserve your love or your goodness or your grace or anything. I know who I am. Come hungry and you will be filled. I told you the Beatitudes are a snowball rolling down a hill. They all build on each other. So what I want you to see here is just the progression of how these are building. Starts with blessed are those who are poor in spirit, and then blessed are those who mourn. So if we start our story with Naaman, Naaman is poor in spirit. What I mean by that is he's sick and he knows it. He's sick. We are told to be poor in spirit. He is poor in health, if you want to think of it that way. We're told to be impoverished spiritually, recognize that we have nothing to offer. He's got a disease that's incurable. He knows it. So he starts as poor in spirit. Then we're told to mourn, to grieve our brokenness. And he begins to grieve his brokenness by seeking a solution. He knows he's dying of a disease, and he's so desperate for a cure that he leaves his homeland. He travels around the world looking for a solution. So you can think of Naaman as someone who is poor in spirit and who has grieved or has mourned. And now, on top of this, now the man who knows he is dying and the man who has gone seeking for a solution, now this man, on a much deeper level, must become meek. He comes to the person who has a solution. He has already come to another land. He already knows he has a problem. Now he's come to the person who has a solution, and he has to actually admit how little he is able to help himself. He has to actually admit that the invitation to dip into a river that's too gross for someone as important to him is an incredible invitation. He has to lower his head and say, and I can do nothing to help myself. Like he's come with wagon loads of gold. He knows he can't cure his own leprosy, but he still wants to contribute something to the process. He still wants to be able to afford something here. He wants his importance to matter. And this line that he comes to say, which is basically, I can do nothing to help myself, that line is maybe that's really all some of you need to hear this morning. If you leave this morning with nothing else, that's the line that we need to hear and remember. I can do nothing to help myself. You know you aren't perfect. You know it's a problem. And maybe you've come to Jesus looking for the solution. You've traveled all this way. And you need to now get your head around the fact that you still can't do anything to help yourself solve the sin problem in your life. You'd be willing to give away a lot to remove some of the guilt in your past, to remove some of the habits that you currently struggle with. You'd be willing to, if Naaman's willing to give wagon loads of gold, you'd be willing to do something equivalent. You'd be willing to give away a lot. And we have to come to this point where we recognize, I can do nothing to help myself. Elisha just says, go wash in this specific river. Or in our case, what Jesus says is just turn from your sin and trust in the finished work on the cross. You know you have a spiritual problem, but you need to now be meek. Those who come with meekness are the ones who receive blessing. They're the ones who receive the bliss that abides. And not just bliss that abides. There's a promise if you read the verse. Those who are meek are the ones who inherit the earth. What on earth does that mean? Well, the meek are the only ones who enter the kingdom of heaven. They're the only ones who enter the kingdom of heaven. Let me read you a quote from A.W. Pink. I think it's helpful here. I'll put it on the screen. Man wants to have a hand in his salvation. To be told that God will receive not from him, that salvation is solely a matter of divine mercy, that eternal life is only for those who come empty-handed to receive it solely as a matter of charity, this is offensive to the self-righteous religionist. Not so to the one who is poor in spirit and who mourns over his vile and wretched state. The very word mercy is music to his ears. The only ones who come to receive what Jesus is giving are the ones who are aware that they can contribute nothing. They say, you know what? I can do nothing to help myself, and God will receive not from me. I am wholly reliant on his grace. All I can do is cling to the goodness and the work of somebody else. And these are the ones who inherit the earth. Come hungry, and you will be filled. Let's have a look at verse 6. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, not for food, for righteousness. And then it comes with a promise. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness will be filled. Being hungry and being thirsty is not the same as wanting something. Wanting ice cream and being thirsty for water are two different things. One is a desire you can suppress. I know you're going to tell me that's not true. I know you are. Oh, I have to have ice cream. It's not just a want, it's a need. It's a different thing. You cannot suppress the urge for water, at least not for long. The Christian that Jesus describes as being blessed or happy is the Christian who is longing for, who is in desperate need of the daily practice of Christ-likeness. Blessed are the ones who live with a constant desire for purity, who are working to fight sin and to find freedom from everything that besets them. Blessed are the ones who take seriously what Jesus has taught and work hard to put these things into practice. When Oliver asks the cook for more food, the cook hits him with a ladle. But the ones who come to Christ and say, look, I desire to live out your teaching. I want to live this way. I want to look more like you. I want to be utterly transformed. Christ is generous beyond generous to these people. It says you'll be filled or satisfied. That's what it says here. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness will be satisfied. We've had a lot of hot days this summer. So just in the last 3 weeks, you've experienced this feeling, I think you have anyway, of coming in from the outside when it's real hot. You're dripping with sweat. It's been a real hot day. It's 36 or whatever. And you take a big swig of water and, oh my goodness, it hits a spot you didn't even know you had. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah, when you are really hot and you come in, you know you're sweating, you know you need something, you drink some water and you're like, whew, that is satisfying. That is what Jesus describes here. It's not like you're never going to want water again. But boy, does it hit the thing that you were looking for. Sometimes it hits a need that you didn't even know you had. It just fills you in a way you didn't even know you were looking for. That is what Jesus is offering here. Jesus does not offer a blessing for hungering after the knowledge of the Bible. He does not offer a blessing for those who are scared of the consequences of sin. He says, blessed are people who hunger for righteousness itself. And Christians all the time are dissatisfied and they're looking for something that will fill them. And they come to a church and they attend for 2 or 3 years and then they don't find some kind of perfect fellowship. So they go on and they try a different church and they come to one sermon series and then they hear that another church has a different sermon series and it's a little more interesting to them. So they run after that and they heard about this church which has cool worship on Sundays. So they quickly go there and they attend this group for a while, but then it doesn't quite have the topic that's interesting to them or the friends that they were looking for. So they try a different one and they spend their whole life running from thing to thing and they're dissatisfied. They're looking for something to scratch a little itch in them and they think it's going to happen. And the only thing that is satisfying, the only thing that actually hits the spot is the pursuit of righteousness, is actually coming to look more like Jesus. And we live our lives desperately thinking, oh, if I learned a little more, as long as it's, you know, something based on the Bible, if I learn a little more, that'll satisfy me. Or if I'm entertained a little more, as long as it's worship that's entertaining me, that'll satisfy me. Or if I find the right fellowship, it's going to be Christian fellowship, that'll satisfy me. And we are left constantly dissatisfied and looking for something else. The only thing that is actually going to satisfy your heart is the practice of righteousness. Blessed are the people who hunger and thirst for righteousness itself, not the knowledge of it, not being in the presence of it, the actual practice of it, the righteousness itself. There is a very big difference between watching soccer and playing soccer. And there's a very big difference between hungering and thirsting for learning about righteousness and hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Every week in discipleship groups, we ask all of our groups to set goals. People struggle with this. It's frustrating. It's hard. I understand all of that. But why do we ask you to set goals? Because there is no blessing for learning more of the Bible if we don't actually put into practice its teaching. Sorry, that's me. I'll try to fix that. Hopefully that works. I move too much and it swings around. Blessed are people who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are people who hunger and thirst to actually act more like Jesus every day. So blessed are the meek, and blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. There's bliss that abides for those who can see their problem and own it, and those who come to God desiring to look and act differently than they do right now. There's often two kinds of people in the world. There's people who believe themselves to be good. Whatever they have, whatever they've done, whatever they are doing, they think it's good enough. And then there's another kind of person who really believes themselves to be bad. They're just too awful. God could never love me. I'm the worst kind of person. The line we used to always say, I don't hear this so much anymore. The line we used to always say is, if I were to set foot inside of a church, I would burst into flames. Remember people used to say that? Oliver Twist is neither of these. He is neither of these. He does not sit on the bench and think to himself, I can find my own food later. He does not sit on the bench and think to himself, you know what, I'm good. It's okay, I've been fed enough. He does not sit on the bench and think, I am not worthy of any more, and he will definitely say no, and nobody will give me anything. He does not do any of those things. Meekness is not arrogance, and it is not groveling. He does not come up demanding. He comes up and very humbly asks for something that he believes he will receive. The difference between Oliver Twist and our God is that when we raise up our bowl and we say, please, sir, may I have some more of what you are offering, when we, like Oliver, acknowledge our condition, know that we are hungry, go to the one who gives something, God gives and he gives generously. Let me just take kind of 2 minutes here and just give you some practical steps to close this off. What are some practical steps towards meekness and towards hungering and thirsting for righteousness? If I go back to my original analogy, meekness is kind of this idea of a peasant with his head at the right height as he enters before the king. You know, what you need to think about is not having your head too high, not having it too low. So let's start with a head that's too high. Some of you, maybe you don't see your need for meekness. You see your relationship with sin as taken care of. You're satisfied with your level of righteousness. You're satisfied with how hard you're working to be good. And you need to be reminded of how poor in spirit you actually are, how spiritually impoverished you actually are. Good step for you is to reassess your sin, to actually take a good long look at the practices of your life. Helpful place is to start by reading the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. Even just the rest of Matthew 5, we've read the first 12 verses of Matthew 5. If you just read the rest of Matthew 5, you will find all kinds of very humbling teachings. He says things like this: if you're holding a grudge against someone, you aren't even in a place where you should be offering any service to the Lord. He says lust is a form of adultery. He says you shouldn't need to swear oaths because you should be so reliable that when you say you're going to do something, you can just be held to it. He says you need to love your enemies. Just in Matthew 5, just in this chapter, Jesus says all kinds of things, very practical, daily practice things that I think are incredibly humbling. If you read just this chapter, let alone the rest of Jesus' teachings, I think it will cause you to lower your head. It's helpful to be aware of how much we fall short, not so that you're crushed by that knowledge, but just so that you are aware of how desperately we actually need the Lord's help. Some of you have your head too high. Some of you have your head too low. You know you don't live how you ought. You know you aren't worthy. You know you aren't as mature in your walk as you can be or as you should be. And you need to know, not only is he still willing to have you and work in you, but he offers you his blessing just for acknowledging that you are in that state, just for acknowledging your own lack. Now you need to hunger and thirst for righteousness. Don't be satisfied to be hungry. Don't be satisfied to be poor in spirit. Look for something more. Good next step for you is to just reassess what it is you are currently hungering for. Why do you do the spiritual things you do? Why do you come to church? Why do you read your Bible? Is it so you can be free from consequences? Is it to find belonging, to find community, to gain knowledge? Because you want to be entertained? What is your motivation for coming to church, for reading the Bible, and so on? We want a hunger and thirst to be transformed. We want a hunger and thirst for righteousness. Something you can do is also just read through the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. See what Jesus asks of people. See what he commands people to do. Ask him to help you grow into the person that he describes in this sermon. Make that the thing that you hunger for. My motivation for reading the Bible today is I want to learn to look more like the guy that Jesus describes. My reason for coming to church today is I want to look more like the person that Jesus describes. Ask him to help you grow into the person that you are a million miles short of. Don't be crushed by your shortcomings. Just thirst to look more like Jesus. Let me invite the worship team back up to the stage here. Whether you, whichever of these you think you fall into today, head is too high, head is too low, either way, good homework for both of you, for all of us, for everybody who's here this morning, good homework for us this morning is to read the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. That is Matthew 5-7, 5, 6, and 7. If you're looking for some reading, here's my advice, here's my genuine encouragement for this afternoon. Take a pen and paper, read the Sermon on the Mount, and just make notes. What is Jesus saying to do and not to do? Just go through and read the Sermon on the Mount and make a list. What does Jesus say to do and not to do? I think that this is genuinely humbling, and I think it is an incredible vision of what we are hungering for. I want to be that guy. I'm not, but oh, I desperately want to be. Come hungry, and you will be filled. Come hungry, and you will be filled. And we need the Lord. We need the Lord for this. So desperately, we are in need of his work. We can do nothing on our own. We are so desperately in need of him. And so that is what we are going to sing right now. Would you stand as we sing together? Lord, I need you. Oh, I need you.
Thank you for joining us today for another encouraging message from God's Word. Our prayer is that you have been built up and spurred on to take the next step in your walk with Jesus Christ. At Harbor, our vision is to glorify God as we share the gospel, make disciples, start churches, and multiply leaders. Our mission is to see everyone in our church walking with someone from disenchantment to discipleship. If you have questions about who Jesus is, would like to be prayed for, or if you would like to talk with one of our pastors, please visit our website at harborfellowship.com. We would love to connect with you. If you have questions about the ministries of Harbor Fellowship Church, would like training in how to share the gospel, or if the Lord is prompting you to support the ministries of Harbor financially, please visit our website, harborfellowship.com. Join us next time as we once again open God's Word together and take the next step from disenchantment to discipleship. This podcast is a production of Harbor Fellowship Church in St. Catharines, Ontario.